those are the characteristics of the perfect challenge. It's somehow you're approaching it and it's deliberate and it's positive and it's a quality and it's internal to you. So if you do those things, you'll find yourself able then to cheerfully engage and work with intensity without any grimness and without any rushing.
Hey, this is Sharif here with another episode of The Golden Hour, back with Dr. Kevin Majors. Kevin, good to be back here with you.
Hey, Sharif, great to have you back.
Yeah, it's been a couple months for me. I mean, you've gotten to do a couple episodes since then, but this is my first episode back, so I'm kind of excited for it.
That's right. I guess summer goes longer in California.
That's right. Well, it's going to be summer for the next couple of years here. So, well, Kevin, actually, speaking of LA, where I am, so someone was telling me a story, so I want to kind of get your thoughts on this. So I'm always looking for ways to explain optimal work to people better. And this person was telling me about the moment when they finally understood optimal work. So I thought, well, this is very interesting. So let me tell you the moment that got them to understand it, and then we can kind of reflect on that a little bit. So what they said was, basically they had this seminar coming up. It was the following week, and they had blocked out time over the weekend to prepare for it. But just things kept coming up, and it ended up that Monday morning, which was the first day of the seminar, they had an hour to prepare for the whole thing. I think it was like 3 days. And so they said, okay, this is unprecedented. And so what did he do? He just made a checklist, realized, wait, I think I can actually do this. And worked through it very intensely because he was under complete pressure to like finish it by 9 a.m. And he said, that's when I understood optimal work, that when you increase the challenge, when you have this big challenge, it can actually bring out the best in you and you can do your best work. What do you think about that?
I would say he's about 80% of the way there.
Okay.
So, because there is a vision that he has of thriving on challenge, not by avoiding it, but by embracing it. So I think we have to give kudos to anyone when they are engaging a challenge like that. And do you think that he was being really positive about the challenge?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was almost like an athletic sense of I can do this. Like I want to engage this thing. Yeah.
We'll go through these more slowly perhaps, but then how much do you think he was aiming for a quantity to get done versus the quality he would aspire to possessing while doing it and through it?
I think there was probably a lot of quantity. I want to finish this task by the time the thing starts.
Yep. And so he was deliberate to some extent in going through it, but I would have to think he was also pretty rushed. Yeah, and so there'd be something about his way of being intense that was kind of automatic or automated. So that's another thing. But the biggest thing is that it was something external that was doing it. And so he was kind of being ruled by externalities. And I think that optimal work is about internally generating your own way of embracing a challenge, so that challenge brings out your very best. And it's fully deliberate, totally positive, and you are aiming to grow by means of it. And so maybe one way of like thinking of it is, what was his internal attitude while doing the work? Was it joyful or was it somehow serious or grim? You know, and maybe he was joyful. Maybe that's like supplied a lot of what was. So, because I think that if it's done optimally, it's done cheerfully and it's done deliberately. So I would say again, he had most of the qualities there that we would aim for, but it's such a great vision of intensity. I think that's a topic that some people are scared of, is intensity in work. Just the phrase like intensity in work could seem off-putting. You know, and what he experienced was that intensity in some way could be exhilarating and exciting and enthusing. So I think that's maybe he's more than 80% there.
Yeah. 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 And then the other element that jumped out to me was, we talk a lot, you know, challenging yourself according to your highest ideals, which is, I think, what you were alluding to earlier. And so there's the sense of the challenge coming from within. You're internally challenging yourself, and then also according to ideals, not just to get a quantity of work done. But I know this person, and I know he was very motivated by a spirit of service and wanting to do his best for the people who were going to be at the seminar. So.
Yeah. And that goes also into how positive it was and how quality oriented it was. So that's really important, those kind of qualities.
Right. Right. So now optimal work is very connected to your work as a psychiatrist, obviously treating people with anxiety, where the challenge is very much, at least starting, I would think, on the outside, say someone with fear of heights or fear of public speaking or fear of these kind of difficult situations. So that seems very similar then to his case, no? But you're trying to help them flip the challenge to make it internal. But there's always going to be this kind of external challenge, right?
Yeah. So there, that external challenge is going to be the setting, the situation for the internal challenge. But you have to be able to make the challenge completely your own. So there's a sense in which we are totally accepting of the present moment and living almost like a sense of abandonment of judgment with regard to the present moment and any challenges that might arise in it. As those challenges arise, we use that as the occasion then to challenge ourselves in some way. I think that's the secret. It has to come from within. That once the challenge is internalized, you get energized by it. So, but if it stays external, I think it's very enervating. So you actually lose energy from challenges looming over you. Because just a lot of overhead processing, like, oh, I have that to do, that to do, that. There's all these challenges are kind of hanging over the head. So what optimal work tries to do is teach people how to change the locus of challenge from being something outside of them to something within them, within their will, so that they're saying yes to it and embracing it. So the most fundamental question usually is, in like my upcoming hour of work, am I seeing the challenges that might arise as obstacles to be avoided? Or am I seeing them as the very means by which I am going to get the work done in a new and better way? So if you can see challenges as the means, then I think you're looking at your own growth and you're looking at something that's always going to be a positive quality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good point, that if you're viewing the challenges in your work as opportunities to grow and improve in your skills and grow in, according to your ideals, then some unexpected difficulty in the work is a good thing. I mean, it's going to help you even more. But if you're really under the gun and you have an hour to finish preparing this thing and you realize, oh, like this, I just encountered some difficulty. I had no idea this was going to happen. It's going to take 2 hours to do just this part. Now you're not going to see that challenge as really a good thing.
Yeah, no, that's very difficult. And I think in my work as a psychiatrist, I could be looking at, for instance, these qualities. I was just talking with someone about this. I could look forward to the difficulties that will come up in the session as my opportunities to be resourceful and wise and cheerful. Okay, or engaged or understanding. But yeah, I'd choose one of those. Like, I just want to be very resourceful or thoughtful when we come up against challenges. So that would mean then that I'm not trying to avoid difficult areas subtly throughout the session, but instead I'm helping to just go as directly as is feasible to, okay, what is the real challenge? And if I can find where the person is having trouble growing, that's me precisely where I can help them the most. But it's going to require me to be more resourceful and to be quick to think of things. That's kind of what I want to be practicing. So I have to see that as very important to me growing into being the best possible, you know, doctor that I can be. So that's the only way that can happen is by taking, you know, like having real difficulties and real challenging cases and learning to kind of get through it and to make real progress. So I think that anyone can experience that in their work, that it's where the challenges arise. Well, the very reason that those are challenges is because that's where we have growth left to accomplish. And if, you know, if there was no growth left for us there, it'd be super easy right now.
Mm-hmm. So, Kevin, I work a lot with students, and maybe to some extent, professionals have this strategy as well. But the idea is, you know, strategic procrastination, where you put off a thing as long as possible so that you have to do it the last night, and then you get this huge surge of adrenaline. So could you comment on that strategy within the context of what we've been discussing so far with intensity versus stress?
Yeah, it's one step removed from internalizing a challenge. It's setting up the conditions for the external challenge to be greater, so then you're forced to do it. So by procrastinating, I think people learn how to set themselves up to have more adrenaline when the time comes to do it. And then when they actually get to doing it, there's so much motivation they're bringing to it in that adrenaline that it's easy for them to stay on task and to get it done and to do really good work. So there's a lot of good accomplished by strategic procrastination, but there's some mischief in it too. And part of it is that while you have all of that hanging over you, waiting to be done, you are much more likely to distract yourself. As soon as people procrastinate one thing, it's pretty amazing how they will then basically fall for distractions. And so they end up wasting a lot of time, and time often in parts of the day where they could have had really good focus and energy. You know, and then they really, but once you've procrastinated, you're in a kind of different mode. And they will seek other distractions. And then it's not until like perhaps the evening that now they have their adrenaline, but now they're kind of tired. It's the end of the day. It's not the greatest time to get all the work done. So what happens is people become reactionary in their way of life, in their schedule. And so their schedule is just, at, you know, they're not in charge anymore. It's a very different thing when you can just sit down and call forth intensity, basically at will. And put in a really good hour, and then you have a bit of a break, come in, put another really good hour. You can delight in that kind of work. But people who really procrastinate, even strategically, chances are they're not delighting in the work. You know, chances are the quantity challenge is what's giving them all the adrenaline, making sure I get this work done efficiently. But that's, I don't know, efficiency is not an ideal. Efficiency is... It's not a quality, actually. It's just a type of quantity challenge. It just means getting a certain quantity of work done in a certain quantity of time. You know, and that's not very elevated. That's not very enthusing. So the problem is then, yeah, so people never really develop the internal ability to be in charge of their own adrenaline, to be in charge of their own focus, and really develop self-mastery. So you can get by strategic procrastinating, but you're not going to really master yourself.
Right. And maybe some people conflate stress and intensity in their minds. I know that on the inventory, talking about, does my workday consist of a series of high intensity sprints? Some people see that as a bad thing initially. So they give themselves, they say, well, no, I'm pretty calm and relaxed and peaceful. So not high intensity. So I think what's in their mind is stress. Am I stressed out constantly?
Yeah, am I rushing and stressed? Yeah.
Yeah. Can you draw out a little bit some of those characteristics, the differences between intensity and stress, just to help us kind of better understand what it would look like to achieve intensity without stress?
When you're working intensely, I think you increase the intensity by slowing down a bit and making it slightly more deliberate. But when you're working in a way that's stressed out, it seems like the only way to increase intensity is to speed up even faster and to rush yourself. That might be the biggest palpable difference between working with what we call it with optimal intensity versus being stressed out, which is really working in threat mode. So in Latin, there's a saying, festina lente, which means make haste slowly. And that is a beautiful adage because it captures this idea of intensity. When you want to be very intense, you become more deliberate. It seems like you're slowing down, but then your task attention can be totally filling the task at hand. So that there's really nothing left for your default attention to be talking in the head, to be trying to like suggest things that are off task to do. So you end up working free from distraction, free from internal friction. That's how you enter flow. So slowing down to increase how deliberate you are can lead you directly into flow, provided that there's enough of a challenge for you to work on. The best challenges are quality challenges, even then. So you're going to be aiming for a certain way of working, a certain, you know, to be a certain skill or ideal that you're going to be practicing in this time, and then to make it even more slow or deliberate. The Thomas Stirner book, The Practicing Mind, has that example that we've referred to before of he was tuning pianos for a living, and he decided that just as an experiment, he would try to slow down his tuning of the piano so he can give every single string his complete attention. And he practiced doing that string by string until the entire piano was fully tuned. And then he was shocked to find it actually took him half his regular time. He thought it was, you know, so he thought it would have been, I don't know, would have been like, you know, that he had spent, really, it was like a huge difference. You know, that was, that, you know, from what it felt like to him when he was doing it, but he was slowing down. And then time is actually going fast. That's a great example of festina lente, you know, making haste slowly. But it means letting your task attention so fill whatever you're doing right now, just the step you're on, that you don't even have any leftover attention to monitor the passage of time. So I do think it's great to have a stop time. I do think it's great to have an alarm set so that you can have the sense of giving your total attention to it, progressing through the steps, step by step, you know, and then always stopping when the alarm sounds, so you can at least take a break and then get ready to come back.
Mm-hmm. Now, what jumped out to me there is the idea of attention, which is what we were just talking about, so obviously. But specifically, when you're working with intensity, I don't know if there's a neuroscience kind of understanding of this or psychology, but when you're working with what you described as intensity, it's you're devoting 100% of your attention to one thing. Whereas maybe in stress or threat mode or what we sometimes call hyperfocus, it almost has a sense, not that you're dedicating 100% of your attention to something, but that you're kind of narrowing your attention. Like you're narrowing your focus to a kind of small area. So I don't know if there's anything to that, that in one case you have your full attention, but you're just giving it to one thing. Whereas in the other case, you're almost kind of narrowing your attention down. I think in Ian McGilchrist's book, The Master and His Emissary, he talks a little bit about the left brain, right brain attention, that the right brain attention is open to new things and fully open to the world. And so maybe that's corresponding a little bit to intensity, whereas the left brain attentional system, it's the one that does focused attention. It kind of homes in on just one thing.
So I think there can be maybe the thing that's different here is that when you're in hyperfocus, your attention gets narrowed. There's a tunnel effect, but it's passive. So that whatever is the object of your attention has now taken control of your attention. And so the reason you lose track of time when you're in a tunnel, this happens, you know, not just with getting things done, but it can also happen, say, with cravings. A craving gets triggered and someone goes into tunnel vision. And now they lose sight of personal goals and moral considerations and all these things, just the hyper-focused on fulfilling the craving. But that's a capture of attention. And so it's passively narrowed to the thing. It's not something where they have, with full deliberateness, you know, been able to select this deliberately and then totally put all of their attention deliberately into engaging it. So task attention is simply the part of our attention that interfaces with the present moment. The opposite of that is your default attention, which is about the past and future. And that's where the cogitating and the ruminating in the head takes place, the voice in the head. It's always in some way talking about really the past or the future in some way. But task attention is just experiencing the present moment. And so that can be, so whenever you're working, you're going to be using task attention. But there are ways where your attention is captured by something else, and there are ways where you're in charge of deliberately putting it somewhere else. The usual way that we tell people that you can tell if you're in this captured state of attention versus the deliberately placed state is that in hyperfocus, you get irritated when you're interrupted because something broke the attentional hold, and it just is kind of shocking. It's like even when you watch television, if you're really engrossed in a program, it's kind of hyperfocus really because it's passive. Your attention is just being passively captured, and if someone like, you know, turns the light on or interrupts you, you know, it could be kind of jarring. Versus in flow, you've deliberately put all your attention in the present moment, but then the interruption comes and you can put 100% of your attention into the interruption until it's done. And then you can put 100% back in the task at hand. That gets again to this idea that when our attention is more passively captured, that's really compatible with then rushing and rushing and rushing until I try to get it done more. Versus the kind of ability and flow to slow down a bit more. And then the interruption comes, you slow down and then engage the interruption. And then you have to pull back and engage the task at hand one more time. So there's something about it being slow and deliberate that I think is really characteristic, of flow. And this is what we're really talking about here, this intensity of focus. We're talking about the ability to be totally engaged and immersed in the task at hand.
That's right. So, Kevin, how would we achieve this? If you had to choose one of reframing mindfulness and challenge, which would you emphasize for people?
I would emphasize challenge because in this sense, it kind of encompasses them. So I think if you want to work with kind of optimal intensity, you want to be looking at whatever obstacles might come up as the means for progress, a deeper progress than just getting this thing done, but the real progress in life and growing. So that means you're approaching the challenge, and you're ready for it. So the reframe is already implicit in that. The fact that it's kind of deliberate and willing to slow down is also includes the idea of mindfulness, because that's really when you try to do something more mindfully, that means being able to do it more deliberately and slowly. So anytime, even if you're going between things, you can practice this ability by slowing down slightly as you do things. The way you open and close a door, do it a little more deliberately. And you'll find that it's intense and you can actually, there are ways then of like when you slow down and do things deliberately, of bringing even your highest ideals into those smallest actions. And that's kind of a nice practice. I think if you had practiced that a few times throughout the day, your ability to work would go way up because it's the same and exact thing in work. You slow down slightly, you really make sure you're engaging the task and the real challenge. And then having that there's a positive quality you're aiming for, that you're stretching yourself for, that kind of makes sure that it's all internal. So I think if I were to have those, those are the characteristics of the perfect challenge. It's somehow you're approaching it and it's deliberate and it's positive and it's a quality and it's internal to you. So if you do those things, you'll find yourself able then to cheerfully engage and work with intensity without any grimness and without any rushing and without the emptying of real meaning just by trying to get things done quickly.
Mm-hmm. So Kevin, maybe it's been implicit in our discussion so far, but it seems to me that another characteristic of being under stress and being in the state of hyperfocus is that you're kind of focused exclusively on achieving some particular outcome. Like you want to get this thing done. So I wonder if you could speak to that and its relationship to intensity of how determined you are to achieve, some particular thing that you finish.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Because it's the focus on the outcome that makes us see challenges that might arise as threats.
As, yeah.
So it's the focus on the outcome that makes us perhaps then, you know, like more automatic, more negative, just quantity focused, like getting it done, which is attaining the outcome. And the outcome is something external to us. So it seems like that might be a way of summarizing all these things, that the real thing, you know, that's a great point. The real thing is actually that when you're focused on the outcome, that's when all this negativity kind of enters. If you're focused on, what's the opposite of that? Well, in psychology, it's outcome goals versus process goals. But the process goals, that sounds weird. What we're really talking about is a growth in your knowledge, in skills, in good habits, so ideals, you know, and in your relationships, your bonds with others. So those are all intrinsic to you. They stay within you. And so we often call them intransitive goods. So they're intransitive because they don't pass out of you into the task or into the thing done. So the well-painted fence, that's the outcome. That's a transitive good. It passed out of you while you're painting. So painting well was to produce a well-painted fence. And I often think that if people would only focus on these intransitive goods, these are the things that actually endure that are in them, almost nothing they view as a threat would actually be a threat. Almost everything is turned into an opportunity just by asking, how can I really grow myself by means of this? What skills, virtues, bonds can I be deepening in myself by means of this? And that's really the content of every reframe, is like some kind of intransitive good, something in me that I'm going to grow in. So I do think that's right, that when we get too focused on attaining a particular outcome, which is like getting it done, that's when we set up what the threat is and we get this external locus of challenge. So if we, you know, the hardest thing though is letting go of transitive goals or goods, you know, that, because it seems like, well, that's why I'm here. That's what I'm doing. And it's like, well, no matter what we're doing, maybe the better motive for doing it is how we can grow and then how we can grow closer to others through it. So skills, virtues, bonds, that those deepen. That should really be the deepest goal that we have.
Yeah. It's interesting that you have this kind of hierarchy, skills, virtues, bonds. One thing I've been thinking a little bit more about lately is fitness and fitness goals. So it seems to me like fitness is kind of like introducing you to this idea of intransitive goods, mm-hmm. where you're just shaping your kind of athletic performance, which does stay within you. But it does seem like kind of a lower goal than, you know, growing in.
So we'll say muscles, skills, virtues, bonds.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we can always just put that at the bottom. Still good. Exactly. Exactly. It's an intransitive good.
It's a certain kind of intransitive good.
Awesome. Well, Kevin, I think that's a great note to end on. Thanks so much for being here.
Great having you back, Sharif. And thanks for having me.
Yeah, we'll be back next week. Well, thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the episode. Don't forget to check out OptimWork.com for a set of online tools to help you engage challenge in your life. See you next week.